I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping, greenly spirits of trees and a blue, true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today. And this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and love and wings and of the gay, great happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any lifted from the know of all, nothing human, merely being doubt, unimaginably you? Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. E.E. Cummings. Ah, summertime. Pattern of life indelible, as E.B. White said in his essay, Once More to the Lake, a piece which evokes his favorite lake in Maine in such sensory images that even a city dweller can be transported. You'll hear more from that essay later in the show. These days, when the seasons seem to be confused, when much of the world is experiencing a bewildering array of unusual weather patterns, true classic summer seems even more precious. Though the long, hot summers of youth are probably past for most of us, today the Mind's Eye writers will reawaken these distant glimmerings in Hot Enough For You? Or Our Summer Times. For many teenagers, summertime is not just the season of surcease of suffering from homework, but rather their initiation into what will be a lot less romantic in years to come, summer jobs. Geither Waltzen helps us recall that bittersweet experience.
There are few phrases able to invoke nostalgia, good or bad, than summer jobs. Summer jobs smelled of baby oil, cut grass, tutti-frutti ice cream, salt air, pine trees. Summer jobs sounded like a particular summer song, a manager's voice coming over the loudspeaker, 100 screaming campers. Summer jobs were where we often ventured out beyond the circle of our school friends, perhaps working with kids from the next town or even from a different culture. Summer jobs were also the place where many of us received our first paychecks. And along with that paycheck, perhaps a spark of hope, or maybe delusion, that we might just survive in that infinite world beyond our parents' control. We summer jobbers were a force. We were the lifeguards, camp counselors, gas jockeys, ice cream peddlers, drive-in movie attendants, lawn cutters, construction laborers, and nannies. Without us, entire tourist industries would have come to a standstill. Ice cream would have gone unscooped and unlicked, and rich people's children would have turned into aimless, petty thugs. But perhaps most importantly, summer jobs had the capacity to make us realize, when we witnessed those same rich kids to whom we taught canoe paddling skills, and who didn't seem to need summer jobs, that we were most likely destined to be working stiffs. Just like our parents. For me, a child of Norwegian working-class immigrants, and by proxy a devotee of the Protestant work ethic, allowance was never part of the picture. So at age 11, I became officially employed in my first summer job. Gas jockey. I proudly sported an oversized dark green Texaco shirt with the Texaco star emblazoned on my left breast. I worked at my Uncle Johann's boat marina, a job that involved 8 hours of sprinting the 50 yards between the ship's store at the boat launching ramp and the gas dock itself, jutting out into the river. At the gas dock, I serviced any boat with an engine, from locals in small fiberglass speedboats to strangers in 50-foot yachts. Surly clam diggers would toss their rusting, empty 6-gallon red metal tanks on the dock, and I'd fill them. In turn, my 90-pound weakling frame struggled to lift the swollen tanks back down to the boat. The yachts were a different story, their names gold-leafed on their sterns. The Judy B., the Rachel, the more clever captains opted for the more poetic handles. Just Driftin', Busman's Holiday, In the Drink, which most of the crew were. The captains were not captains at all, but rather Wall Street businessmen, anointing themselves admiralty with the simple donning of gold-laced captain hats. The result of this egotistical delusion was frightening. Unfamiliar with the subtleties of watercraft, the soft-handed paper pushers would simply aim their massive bows at the gas dock and shout instructions to their gum-chewing Judy B. wives standing on the front deck. These scantily clad, bejeweled, and bleached blonde women held the bow line like a limp, well, snake. And inevitably, Judy B. would toss the line too early, careful, of course, not to break her nail. And inevitably, it would land short of my outreached hands and into the river. Then, knowing my thin, stick-like 11-year-old arms were no match for holding back a 12-ton cabin cruiser, I would retreat and await the violent shudder and splintering of wood as cabin cruiser met the dock. Besides pumping hundreds of gallons of gas into these beasts, servicing these larger boats always included lugging 25-pound blocks of dripping ice into their galleys, and fetching cases of soft drinks and bottles of tonic and ginger ale for the 4-mile cruise across the bay to Fire Island. I once serviced a yacht carrying Barbara Streisand. I particularly remember the first time one of these weekend sailors offered me a tip for my work. I held up my hand and shook my head, telling him quite seriously that my mother told me I was never to accept money from strangers, which of course caused gales of laughter from the captain and the crew. And more than once I was openly winked at by oiled and bronzed men in Speedos as I gassed up their speedboat for the trip to Fire Island. I didn't mind. They were the best tippers and seemed to be having the most fun. My other work at the marina was to keep happy the 20 or so cabin cruisers that docked for the summer at the marina, providing floating housing for summer-long and weekend boating families. These weekend captains seemed more sober about their lack of seafaring skills, and so most of these boats never left their slips. Their captains obviously content to dream of life on the sea as they cram themselves and their families into the narrowed bunks below decks. The summer I was 13, I fell in love with one of the inhabitants of these idle crafts, Franny Poddick. A tall, gangly girl, my age, though seemingly much older and exotic because she was a city girl. Any excuse to deliver a paper to her father or simply pass by on my way to the gas dock filled me with longing. She didn't seem to notice. One day, caught in Franny's spell, I tripped on a dock cleat and tumbled into the oily waters of the basin. At the end of the summer, Franny left, and I was left dreaming. But the coup de grace of summer jobs was that first paycheck. The numbers $27 stamped out real official-like, and my own name typed after the two. The world seemed to shift. I was on my way. I instantly imagined a string of checks arriving every week for the rest of my life, faithfully reminding me that I was worth something. And that summer would always be the season of plenty. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Get out and get under, get out and get under, to fix your automobile. That was a little tune sung to me by Doc Brower, our neighbor, whose yard I mowed every summer. The early cars, he would explain, had something called chain drive. The way he said chain drive, wistful, a little squirrely, and the peculiar quality of this memory, not of Doc Brower telling me the story as much as my telling it to other people, the sense that this was a real classic childhood story, one of the few I could tell, first of all coming from a neighbor named Doc, old Doc Brower, old Doc. It sounded so normal. Like a neighbor that Beaver Cleaver would have, old Doc. Next, the suggestion that I was a regular, spunky, responsible, enterprising, Horatio Algerish kind of kid. Our neighbor, whose yard I mowed. Yeah, I mowed Doc's yard and a couple of others every summer, but it was a grudging, socially excruciating experience, going to their houses, ringing the bell, praying, mostly praying, that they weren't home. It was all just more agonizing challenges to my over-the-top shyness and lassitude, and the evocation of a distant past by a kindly old codger across the street. This, too, is the sort of quotidian Americana that my chronically anxious, bored, confused, inattentive whacked-outness usually rendered incomprehensible when I heard these life stories offered by parents, grandparents, or teachers. Somehow, old Doc Brower's story survived. That was a brief excerpt from a current novel in progress by me, Greg Williard, entitled A Journal of the Blank Year. While photographs and postcards can remind us of those distant, exotic places where we spent our summer vacations, poetry can do the same things even better. Josie Zell shows us what it feels like to travel in ancient and medieval South Italy in the following poems, Riding the Bus in Campania and After the Siesta.
Riding the Bus in Campania. Red tile roofs and brown stone castles, solid against a blue gauze sky, rise above tranquil yellow wheat fields and rich black earth that stops the eye. Stenciled under brooding mountains is a city gleaming in the sun. Towers, campanili, undistinguished homes where life ends as it was begun. Emerald umbrella pines in two straight lines shade a painter's road, but we're swept along by oleanders for miles of flowers, white and rose. After the siesta. They don't go far, these women, sitting their backs to the street, facing their houses, tatting a lacy collar or bonnet, as the afternoon grows late. They know that on the piazza, inscrutable each alone, all the men of Barletta, assembled as for some ritual, stand silently as stone.
In her third poem, Zell recounts her experience of a walk across the burning fields, Campi Flagrantes, the areas associated with an entrance to the underworld of the poets Virgil and Dante.
Vulcano Solfatara Pozzuoli. We start out across the leprous plain, shield our eyes from the bright dust, keep our distance from the roped-off center. We watch the steaming sulfur mists spew against stark black cliffs. Note how the seat of the gases has shifted. The once safe observatory is now at its core. We stand at the fence for photos, then hurry away, our throats choking. You let fall a rock on trodden white sand with a hollow boom. Twice you do it for the sinister reverberation. We have approached the grim underworld, heard the ring of its caverns, tasted the grit of its acrid air. Somber, with nervous words, we complete the circular route, trying to shake off the burning memory, trying to find our way back. This is Josephine Zell for Mind's Eye Radio. Thank you.
Some of us are not free to travel great distances in summer, so have to make do with some fantasies constructed in our own backyards or living rooms or attics. Norma Gay Pruitt was inspired to transform her interior landscape by the promise or threat of having her home featured on national television in HGTV and Me.
If the last 2 months or so of my summer were boiled down to a simple dialogue, it would read something like this. You're in. Oh, no, I'm out. Oh, please. Okay, I'm in. We're so sorry. You're out. I'm out? The madness started about a month into summer when somebody wrote an email to me mentioning that House and Garden TV's crew was planning to come to Wisconsin and were looking for people with old homes to feature on their series, If These Walls Could Talk. The concept of the show is that sometimes people leave behind mementos of their lives for the next homeowner to find. In my case, I had a modest collection of such goods from one Helen Olson, who had spent her entire life living in the house I now own, and had left behind some relics that so charmed me that on the day I found them, I sat down and wrote a poem as my husband and I retrieved them from the dusty box in the attic. Anyhow, I received a breezy, upbeat email from this young producer saying that they had heard I had an old house and that I had written a poem dedicated to the former tenant and found some of her things. This young assistant producer was interested, nay, fascinated, with my story, which I then pitched to them with great gusto. The emails between me and the young producer flew back and forth, each one increasingly breathless, until the axe fell. Here's a short chronology of the high points. Week 1. I fire up the old fantasy machine and respond to the editor with my poem and best stories about moving into this lovely home. Editor responds vigorously, saying we are exactly what she wants. I still do not have my head completely turned, but am curious. Week 2. I drop a casual, polite notification to my absentee spouse, who now lives and works in Chicago all week, that he might be seeing our attic on TV. Shifting gears quickly, I then blather on about the usual stuff, blah, 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 Alex, blah, 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 rental property repair, blah, blah, repairs to our house. I imagine this is the way he reads my meandering emails. Then, like the cartoon of what the cat hears when you talk to him, which is nothing but his name, I imagine my husband's eyes sticking on the phrase about a TV camera and our attic. Week 3. Response from said spouse who tries to let me down easy. Are you completely nuts? They don't want our house. Absolutely not. Week 3.5. I say regretfully no to nice HGTV lady. She says it happens a lot with husbands. I am sad, but the idea has not fully lodged in me yet. Also, I think at this point I would have from June to September to shake the house upside down, find all of Helen's stuff, and set up a little stage play upstairs. And I still can't imagine making the deadline. In the attic, of course, is everything we've ever owned. Just the week before, somebody had told me that one look at my house made him feel like a Zen monk in terms of encumbrance. Week 4. Everything goes back to what passes for normal. We have the gigantic refrigerator debate. A motley crew of swarthy types shows up to hang siding on one of the apartment buildings we own across the street, and I am distracted by overseeing their shenanigans. I buy some new furniture that, when delivered, makes me feel like Alice in Wonderland when she is in the shrunken phase. I determine the floors need refinishing and have to scrunch all the furniture into one room. It's a normal summer for me. Week 5. Somebody calls me back from HGTV, setting off a series of events that make launching the Columbia look like a day's work. I call it the Waiting for Goffman week, for those who recognize the allusion to the movie detailing what happens when a small town in Iowa gets a chance to put on a play. Week 6. The folks at HGTV shamelessly romance me, even offering to use all of their persuasive powers to get my still-reluctant husband to capitulate. I listen, feeling like a 15-year-old nerd who is suddenly invited to the prom by the star quarterback. Surprisingly, Ken, my spouse, is drawn in also, despite the catch. Instead of the misty, dim, far-off date they had originally given me, they would like to come in 10 days. "So sorry, we understand. We will shoot only what you tell us to point the camera at. Scout's honor, no address is ever given." The least of my worries, really, since I doubt that any thief is going to do me the favor of carting pure junk out of my attic. After all, in the next few days, I'm dragging people off the street, begging them to help me make a narrow corridor between heaps of cast-off stuff so that the camera crew can actually walk through. I paid 3 teenage extortionists' wages to do just that. And oh, did I mention that the temperature averaged 97 degrees this summer, making it well over 100 in the attic. Week 7. I begin to rumor the news around. Every waking thought is pointed towards setting the scene. I send picture after picture, a copy of my poem, even suggesting music that I think would be best. I buy expensive plantings that need daily tending, thinking about the garden part of the show's title and how poor my water-starved leggy geraniums will look to the fancy photographers. I am going to put on a show. Meanwhile, belatedly, remembering the reason for this whole extravaganza, I call a couple of friends who work in the archives of the University Library and the Historical Society and beg them to set to work to try to unearth a little bit more info about our Helen Olson. They graciously accept the challenge. Whenever I buy anything, I casually mention that it might appear on national TV when the camera crews for HGTV show up. I'm in a froth from morning to night. The weekend before shooting is to begin, I'm able to leverage my worry into my husband's ripping a huge aperture in the attic, a floor-to-ceiling opening for the gigantic arch window I have purchased, so that the crew will have enough light to film. Let me tell you, nothing gets your attention like seeing your middle-aged businessman husband hanging out a third-story gaping hole with a ripsaw in his hand. But miracle of miracles, the window actually fits, and after some heart-fluttering moments involving ropes and the entire siding crew, plus a neighbor to interpret our wishes into Spanish, and the window flopping face down on the roof, then arising unscathed, we have a lovely view of the garden. Week 8. I have taken to wearing my cell phone on my hip like an expectant father or an EMT. So I'm nestling the latest of the scene-setting flowers into a pot on the front porch when the phone rings. And you know what? I think I know who it is and why before the voice begins to apologize. It's not their fault, but the network, you know, and cancellations from two other families, and maybe in December, but probably not. And so, sickeningly, on. I am now reduced to such a slavish, pathetic state that I do not even scream at them, "Why the heck did you flirt with me like that?" There is, after all, a glimmer of hope that this is just a postponement. If I was the wallflower 15-year-old before, now I'm the bride left at the altar. But if these walls could talk right now, I want HGTV to know they would not be using the kind of language Helen Olson would approve of. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, listening to her own walls for Mind's Eye Radio.
The Last Summer.
Madison writer Bridget Birdsall.
I remember when they made this stuff with real lemons, my father says, without complaint, setting the can down on the table between us, across an arid mesa. I reach for the can, scanning its label. What, you don't like natural flavors in yellow dye number 5? He smiles. I'm telling you, kid, this stuff will kill you. I shrug, remembering the millions of times I'd said the same thing about his whiskey. Our eyes meet, only for a moment, and we both look out toward the water. It's the blue hour, that scrap of time between dusk and dark, when everything is obscured by shadows and filled with some bleak promise of tomorrow. Disturbed by the distant roar of a fisherman's motor, a flock of Canadian geese take to the air, skidding across the surface in a great cacophony of barks. Sure sign of summer's end, my father sighs. I nod. He shakes his head. I can't do another one, he says. His words scatter in the cool autumn wind. No sadness in his statement, simply fact. Yes, you can, Dad, I say, and remind him of Sanibel Island in December, adding that perhaps the only redemption of global warming is shorter winters. He straightens his back and struggles awkwardly to his feet, holding his bad hip, worn raw with years of delivering mail, rain or shine. Pain pierces his face. Short or not, I hate winter. I say nothing as he limps away. No formal goodbyes between us. Just one last summer. Sailing Lessons. We met in July of 77. Summer was sleek and strong and blonde, with a quick wit and a warm laugh. Her sky-blue eyes sparkled as she invited me to the water. I'll teach you to sail, she promised. I picked her up in my dad's green Chevy. On the way, she chewed juicy fruit gum. We sat on beach towels spread across the cracked leather seats, our tan bodies greased with lotion, the scent of banana mixing with sweet sweat and watermelon. At the water's edge, summer pushed the sunfish out onto the spring-fed lake. There was no wind. Again and again we tried to gain ground, but only sat, stranded in the middle. The sun was hot. Summer stood up on the edge of the boat and began to rock from side to side. Her laughter suddenly lost as the sunfish turtled, dumping us both into the chilled water. Summer surfaced, still laughing, as I clung to the slippery side of the boat. Our bodies touched beneath the water. To anchor herself, she wrapped her arms around me. Without thinking, I wrapped my legs around her. Breast to breast, our hearts beat wildly together, to a song I had never heard, to a song I will never forget. And for one fateful moment, we both stopped struggling. I leaned in to kiss her, but she slipped from my grasp and was gone. Frantically, I searched. She was nowhere to be seen, and I dove deep into the murky depths, plumbing for a flash, a smile, some sign. The air pierced my lungs, forced me back up into the light, where summer popped up, laughing. Why did you do that? I demanded, unable to hold back the tears. She took the rope at the stern and began to pull us toward the shore, and I let her, knowing I had just learned the lesson of a lifetime. This is a poem I keep posted above my writing station at home, and it reminds me of summer and faith. The Summer Day by Mary Oliver. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what prayer is, I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me what it is you plan to do with your one wild and precious life.
That was Madison writer Bridget Birdsall. Sometime around the 4th of July, we begin to get a little antsy. Summer begins to show signs of premature aging, and the memory of that blissful Memorial Day kickoff picnic is melting like a popsicle in the sun. But cheer up! There's a whole second act in this summertime play. We'll travel with one writer to the Chicago of her youth, and with another to New Jersey. Yet another reminds us that, as Robert Frost reported, Earth's the best place for love. And as our poet reminds us, especially in summer. Are the summers truly elastic affairs that stretch during childhood and shrink when we inevitably grow up? Science doesn't support that notion, but, as Esther Cameron laments, if you think the season is growing hotter and drier than you can recall it being, it's not just your perception. But then again, for those who appreciate the small pleasures despite the heat, summer has its rewards.
I have two poems about summer. The first was written in 1988, which, like the past summer, was a summer of drought. One word in the poem may need explaining: orogeny. Orogeny is the process by which a mountain chain is made, something that happens perhaps once every 100 million years. It has an epigraph from Hölderlin. What use is a poet in an impoverished time? Poet in time of drought. The trees have on their final green, likewise such weeds whose roots are deep. I walk where waters moved, and crows share their new-found land with me, above the cracks cawing aloud. A current in the sea, they say, has dragged the global winds off course. That makes the grass to crackle so, and yon choke-cherry's leaves to curl, and farmers to bewail their loss. The birds are singing still, although for all we know the current may decide it likes its present bed, and no rain fall here ever again until the next orogeny. What do you say to that, Red Wing? Even so, the current of men's will has set against my deep desire, and since the bottom of the heart is clearer known than ocean floor, I do not hope to see it turn. That I was born to make lament for this seems merely accident. Yet I give thanks for that in me that will not know of what I know, and, ignorant as a bird, sings on. The second poem is called Forgetting History. They appear in the green shadows like stars coming out. At first, I see only the red, unripe fruit, then the black ones were there all along. As I move among the canes, picking, something scuffles close by. my coming has interfered. And here the vines are flattened as if a deer had lain down, perhaps. I am one of the owners, the masters, no longer in the secret. Yet tonight, when I close my eyes, the black raspberries will appear once more, on stems fragile as the lines connecting the stars that guided the tribes before they named the Great Bear and scattered. Like stars, these clusters have led me forth from the cities into which time drove us. I can imagine the grandmothers move beside me, picking and gossiping, or singing in their language, of which no word remains unless a place name, origin unknown. It is summer. The days have just begun to shorten. The cool, bright sunlight that comes after a berry-making rain falls through the leaves. The hand reverts to a movement reflexive as sucking. I have all that I need. I'm Esther Cameron from Mind's Eye Radio.
Once More to the Lake by E.B. White, 1941. Summertime, oh summertime, pattern of life indelible, the fade-proof lake, the woods unshatterable, the pasture with the sweet fern and the juniper forever and ever, summer without end. This was the background, and the life along the shore was the design. The cottages with their innocent and tranquil design, their tiny docks, the flagpole and the American flag floating against the white clouds and the blue sky. The little paths over the roots of the trees, leading from camp to camp, and the paths leading back to the outhouses, and the can of lime for sprinkling, and at the souvenir counters at the store, the miniature birch bark canoes, and the postcards that showed things looking a little better than they looked. This was the American family at play, escaping the city heat, wondering whether the newcomers at the camp at the head of the cove were common or nice, wondering whether it was true that the people who drove up for Sunday dinner at the farmhouse were turned away because there wasn't enough chicken. It seemed to me, as I kept remembering all this, that those times and those summers had been infinitely precious and worth saving. There had been jollity and peace and goodness. The arriving, at the beginning of August, had been so big a business in itself, at the railway station, the farm wagon drawn up, the first smell of the pine-laden air, the first glimpse of the smiling farmer, and the great importance of the trunks and your father's enormous authority in such matters, and the feel of the wagon under you for the long 10-mile haul, and at the top of the last long hill catching the first view of the lake after 11 months of not seeing this cherished body of water. The shouts and cries of the other campers when they saw you, and the trunks to be unpacked, to give up their rich burden. Arriving was less exciting nowadays when you sneaked up in your car and parked it under a tree near the camp and took out the bags, and in 5 minutes it was all over. No fuss, no loud, wonderful fuss about trunks. Amongst us has not had a summer love when we were young and thought a season's romance could last forever. Poet and songwriter Paul Thompson, accompanying himself on his auto harp, remembers the spell of summer love.
faded photo brings memories of green summer fields, sweet summer mud, lips soft as petals worn by the sun. But summer's gone, and flowers are done. Summer love, sweet summer love, summer love, sweet summer. Soft as petals, warm by the sun, but summer's gone, and flowers are done. No longer cries the with the summer and summer love, but still I smile through misty tears, remembering those distant years. Summer love, sweet summer love, summer love, sweet summer love, lips soft as petals, warm by the sun. Summer's gone and flowers are done. When we are young, we cannot see that summer days are quick to flee, and like the clouds that drift above, so vanishes sweet summer love. Summer love, summer love, summer love, sweet summer love, lips soft as petals, worn by the sun, but summer's gone. And flowers are done.
The 6 degrees of separation get all mixed up in camping. Fran Rawl seems to wonder why she's out there, summer after summer.
One thing you find out with a sunroof in a camper is that it's great for stars and birdsong. However, there's almost no night which goes by without a shower of rain. Sitting up to roll up the roof gives you a chance to head for the John if you decide you might not make it till morning. Camping is a constant ritual of dressing and undressing. It's cold when you get up, always cold, and the dew is on everything. Mostly you can't see it, so try not to sit down on anything. The sun is ready to come up. Soon it will be in your eyes. Now the small wood fire is starting to crackle under the big fire-blackened tea kettle, a family heirloom. After the first cup of coffee, half-dried milk cocoa for the kids, a small basin of hot water is set out at the end of the picnic table to wash hands. Then the camp skillet is moved onto the fire stones, bacon put in, and things start to smell even better. After breakfast, things are put in order, grease and eggshells put onto the fire, dishes washed using water from the tea kettle, camp stuff arranged on the table with a plastic cloth over them, fire put out with a bit of water if necessary, and you're ready for the day. If moving camp, wash out the skillet, let it and the tea kettle cool, and put them into their shopping bag storage. The black has burned on so hard it hardly soils the inside of the bag. Bedding folded, clothes sorted, maps consulted, and maybe votes taken. Now is one of the times to see camp birds. Turkey vultures on the next table is surprising. Chickadees eat cereal from the hand, almost the lips. A Clark's nutcracker watches keenly to see if you left anything at all uncovered. A cactus wren eats insects caught on the car radiator. The roadrunner doesn't linger. Suddenly, it's too hot. This is Fran Rawl reporting for Mind's Eye Radio. Ding 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 ding.
Poet John Morgan.
Prayer for golfers in the drought of 88. Dear God, we need some rain. Any little drop that you can spare. Forget the farmer on the plain. Keep our fairways fair. Clodhoppers have their corn and greens that wilted now we see. But what about our greens? Eternal Father, hear our plea. We golfers beseech thee humbly, dear Father, if you want to. Though the fields be crumbly, send us some rain pronto. In the midst of thy drought, parch the peas and hay. But Lord, hear us cry out. Please let us play. Let drought dry up the cotton bowls, shrivel all the vines, but fill up all our water holes. We must play while the sun still shines. Barbecue Holstein and Jersey, but let the cry of four, in the name of thy justice and mercy, ring forth forevermore. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Judith Zuckerman evokes classic sunny images in the following poems.
Summertime. Languid days float like lake breezes, gentle as a muted tenor sax. Over Chicago's old WPA, Grant Park band shell, built by government paying unemployed workers. Smells of hollyhocks drift through the kitchen window where a young man strips an old floor. Layers of lives, newspaper fragments, May 28, 1945, days before World War II in Europe ended. Wide floor planks, sturdy like childhood voices, mellow like Uncle Harold improvising on his bass before the war, only weeks before he was safe in the South Pacific. Kitchen voices from war days. But I can't hear a word they say. Growing up years. Summertime, and the living is easy. She sings, packing her lunch in a brown paper bag. A tuna sandwich on rye bread, celery sticks, potato chips, one peach, two napkins, and one pint glass jar of milk. Under her dad's old blue-gray shirt, hanging over the top half of her jeans, she wears her bathing suit. She unlocks her blue Schwinn bike from the basement storage across from her apartment home. She plops her lunch, towel, blanket, and one Pearl Buck library book in her bicycle basket. Whizzing under the viaduct, past Clark Street, then Sheridan, until the beach and Lake Michigan stretch ahead of her. She spreads her blanket over hot, smooth summertime sand. Ripples of waves break at the shore. How far out is the sandbar today? Sometimes she buys pop or ice cream with her babysitting money or meets a friend. After swimming, she lies on her blanket and sinks her teeth into her sandwich, even enjoying a stray caraway seed stuck between her teeth. Free from her long list of chores, her mom's voice telling her what to do. This is from a collection of my poems titled Amsterdam Days, A Journey Through Poetry. Summertime. Rain and gray skies fade from memory. Sun shines with Italian warmth, Dutch vacation elsewhere to find. Netherlanders bask fair skins, perched in Amsterdam windowsills. In outdoor cafes, they lean back, eyes closed. Only tourists hide under hats. Friends bicycle to the sea. When the sun lingers, the country is on holiday. This is Judith Zuckerman from Mind's Eye Radio.
From the Midwest to the Jersey Shore, we travel through dusk and the mists that nearly obscure the rising summer sunrise with writer Matt Felgus.
I sit on the balcony of my parents' 12th floor beachfront condo, watching from high. People lounging on the sand or swimming in the ocean off this stretch of New Jersey, so small, insignificant their presence. I tower over the neighboring vacation homes and the main road, a straight shot to Atlantic City several miles up this island. Traffic lights at every block, groups of five or six at a time, in sync, from green to red to green. There's a sense of belonging to those clusters of people below. They have their groups, their families. In a few hours, I'll belong to one, eating dinner, having a good-looking time. I return to the balcony now that those inside are asleep. The sky is hazy, almost a tease, like I should be able to see stars if I try a little harder. Atlantic City's brightly lit casinos draw my gaze more than the dim waves. Distant flashes of lightning, and I wait for the thunder. No rain tonight over my balcony, but I watch a thickening fog fade the neon lights, a black finger of a shadow stretching, covering. I can barely see the ocean, but hearing it is what matters now. The closest traffic lights still twinkle red to green, with a momentary yellow that never fails to draw my attention, if only for an instant. I take off my shirt, smell my summer self, suntan lotion, muggy night. Tomorrow, I return home. When I'm back to this balcony, it will be next year, but years never seem to take that long these days. On this, my fifth summer here, those four people, myself from summers past, are sitting with me, right where I left them. One harassed, one heartbroken, one hopeful, one confused. Hope this year's ghost is wiser than the others. It's 5:30 a.m., and I haven't left the balcony. The fog has lifted. Streaks of lightness in the sky over the ocean, but the light from the casinos just as bright. Suppose it's appropriate here that the point of sunrise is not over the ocean, but rather in the direction of the casinos. The sun gets closer to poking up out of the wispy clouds of the horizon. The artificial lights, finally, are starting to pale by comparison. Awaiting next summer, this is Matt Felgus from Mind's Eye Radio.
The sand may still be hanging around in the floor mats of your car, but the cry of the gulls fades, and the photos of the surf just can't quite hold the sound in your ear. The car radio is full of ads for back-to-school clothes, and, at least usually, the nip in the air announces the end of another vacation season. Though we set our minds to enjoying the rest of the seasons, we have to agree with Shakespeare. Summer's lease hath all too short a date. That's our show. Thanks for listening to Hot Enough For You, or Our Summer Times, written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Today's vacationers included Bridget Birdsall, Esther Cameron, Matt Felgus, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rall, Paul Thompson, Guyther Valtzen, Greg Williard, Josie Zell, and Judith Zuckerman. Original music by Barbara Chusett. For more information about Mind's Eye Radio, go to www.mindseyeaudio.com. And you can hear this and other shows online at www.radioforall.net. And that's four, the number four. I'm Greg Williard. Till next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio. Summertime, and the weather is easy.